This is the Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz. This morning, we're joined by Dr. Aaron Fisher of the University of Utah's Huntsman Mental Health Institute, diving into the evolving landscape of youth mental health here in Utah, from promising legislative progress to ongoing gaps in funding, especially in Summit and Wasatch counties.
We'll explore how programs like Live Like Sam here locally are building age-appropriate social-emotional learning, why emerging efforts around digital wellness from social media to AI are so critical, and how innovative multi-generational programs are connecting teens and seniors in powerful ways. Plus, a look at the partnerships helping drive real change across schools, communities, and the state. Dr. Aaron Fisher, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me back on. I really appreciate it.
Well, we spoke to you, Dr. Fisher, about 8 months ago, back in the summer. Maybe it's because I'm really hopeful that we're moving the needle on this very complex puzzle of helping our youth become more resilient and really face some of these mental health challenges that we all face, but especially our youth. In 8 months, what can you say about that?
I think what's important is that in these 8 months, the needle is moving. And sometimes it doesn't feel like it's moved as much as we would like, but there's definitely progress. And I think what's so fulfilling to hear for me is when some of the national organizations that evaluate progress kind of talk about how policy impacts youth. And this year, based on a report that the Childhood Index put out, Utah and New York are actually the national leaders for policy to protect youth, which is great, especially when we're thinking about things like bell-to-bell cell phone bans and things that can maybe get more upstream and help students. So we're definitely seeing progress. It's incremental. And so, yeah, I'm really happy with where things are at, or at least where they're going.
Well, that is really hopeful. So, when we talk about policy change, are we talking about school districts? Are we talking at the legislative, state level? Where are we talking?
Yeah, we're talking at the state level and really thinking about what the legislature is passing to really help to empower youth, to help keep youth safe. There's a lot of really great policy that I think has been passed to help families, especially when we're thinking about youth independence and things along those lines. But really being able to see that everyone could come together and get behind something that really is going to help kids. And so some of those occur in schools, like the bell-to-bell cell phone ban, but some of those also occur in our communities. And I think that's really important because we're seeing this progress not just in one space.
Right now, there's so much discussion about AI, and I know that there's a lot of discussion amongst parents and employees and employers and teachers and everybody. What are you hearing from kids or even hearing about how kids are working in the world with AI right now?
Yeah, it's so interesting because this is a new tool, and it's really come to the point where this tool is very robust and can help people in ways that, were not available even just 6 months ago. So I think, our youth are having their first experience with it as well. And so I think what we've seen across the state is people wanting to kind of do this differently, do AI that is differently than how social media was kind of handled as far as protecting kids. And so what we're seeing is that schools are now required to integrate AI curriculum into the classes like computer science, but we're also seeing parts of AI kind of awareness and just some of the safeguards popping up in digital literacy and some of those other programs that really help kind of from like a health standpoint so that kids can stay safe because it's going to be like the Wild West, it feels like, for the next, I don't know, few years until we really start to understand the impact of AI, especially on learning.
It is going to be fascinating. And as you say, the parental or adult response to the way children soaked up social media was a bit of an afterthought. I don't think anyone imagined that they would be such robust consumers of social media. I think everyone thought maybe it'd be college kids or something. And so, because we're at a point where we can plan ahead a little bit, if it were up to you, what kind of safeguards or guardrails would you put in place for the use of AI for young people?
Yeah, that's such a great question. And I think it depends on the different developmental level of the kids we're working with. But generally speaking, I think that AI can be a tool, and it can be a really useful tool to help augment, people's creativity and their ability to actuate things and to make things, bring things into reality that they're thinking about. I think that needs to be really heavily contrasted against using AI as someone's brain. So essentially, it's doing all of the critical thinking, it's doing all of those connections. Whereas I think we need to use it, like for example, in some of the work that I do, I'm not a programmer. And so now I have tools that can help me take images in my mind and quickly prototype them into something that I can share with my colleagues, which is super cool. But again, it's bringing to life something that's in my brain rather than bringing to life something that's in the computer or the AI's brain.
Yeah. Erin, if we're talking about AI as a tool to help our creativity, I can't help but think about AI as something that acts in such a way that helps young people who may feel otherwise isolated socially. And we've heard some really horrifically tragic stories about chatbots talking children into even dying by suicide and just awful, awful things. However, on the other hand, I've heard about people who may not, they may not be ready to go see a therapist and they kind of are asking AI to help them with some issues. And it's been really positive for a couple of people I've talked to. Where do you land on that? Where are we landing? If we're talking about guardrails, how are we helping kids navigate that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you bring up a really good point because AI creates this incredibly accessible opportunity to workshop ideas. And I think that's really great for kids, for anyone really. I think the problem is if it's without safeguards, then the kind of default is to really validate, which is great, right, on a kind of surface level. But when you're replacing in-person and human relationships, when you're seeking these other things, I think that you lose sight essentially, and it's going to keep validating you. I think the term that I've heard is an AI psychosis, I think is like what's being talked about. And so we kind of want to avoid that because I think the AI will, unless prompted, will create a really positive environment and experience for the user.
Dr. Erin Fisher is our guest, if you're just joining us on The Mountain Life. He is also, in addition to being with the University of Utah's Huntsman Mental Health Institute, on the board of Live Like Sam. And Live Like Sam, of course, is our partner in this episode of our Resilient Youth series. And so Live Like Sam is always seeming to be on the forefront. And I know you must be helping this effort a lot, especially when we talk about age-appropriate emotional, social kind of programming and education. So help us understand what that is, what that kind of programming is.
Yeah, I think that's really important to think about that programming, especially in light of what we previously talked about, where there's these kind of upstream prevention pieces. But if we take all the screens away, now all of our kids are going to interact with each other, and sometimes they won't always know what to do. So we really need programs like the Thrive program that Live Like Sam facilitates in the Park City Summit and Wasatch communities to really have that. Culturally relevant. It's fun, and it teaches the students who are participating it ways to interact, especially if maybe that's not proficient for them or they're not as skilled as some of their other friends. So I think in the absence of programs like that, we're just going to kind of be sitting in a more uncomfortable place because screens are going to be gone and everyone's going to be looking at each other for what to do. So I think, organizations that teach kids what to do and how to be successful, that's really going to be critical as sort of the complementary piece to all these policies.
That makes a lot of sense. Well, you've won awards for your work with youth mental health. Are there any special approaches that you like to take that you feel helps you to understand or make young people comfortable with you?
Yeah, thanks. I think that, the efforts are really hinged on being authentic, but also being really collaborative and inviting youth and caregivers and everyone who's interested in being part of it to have a voice within that. Because I think when an adult tells us a kid what to do, they're just gonna want to do the opposite. And so I think when they feel like they have autonomy, it goes a long way. And so I think that collaborative piece can just not be highlighted enough. And I think sometimes we're moving too quickly to just even pause for a second to ask, is this going to work for you? Or do you like this? And even that piece, I think, can just go such a long way.
Yeah, and sometimes I think we interviewed recently an author of a book called Good Kids, which was fascinating, talking about how sometimes the oldest child or a kid who's never any trouble grows up as functional and yet later in life has some trauma related to it because they don't feel they were necessarily allowed to be a problem or allowed to be angry or allowed to be sad. How can we help our kids, whether they are apparently struggling or apparently in fantastic mental health? How can we make sure that we're getting the real story from them?
Yeah, that really resonates with me. I feel like I was the oldest sibling and kind of fell into that. I'm sure many of us and many of your listeners too. I think it's just being able to have those conversations as early as possible. Knowing that I didn't really have an outlet or that wasn't really like socially kind of like normative within the community or my household, I wanted to create that for my kids. And I think any caregiver, any parent can do that. You just start to talk about it and you start to say, hey, I read this book and it said that the oldest kind of never has permission. Well, I'm giving you permission. So you tell me. And maybe it's not today, but tell me in 5 years. Or maybe they tell you when it really, clicks for them. But I think whether it's immediate or later as a caregiver, just be open to it and ex let that let that experience be explored so that everyone can heal. And I think it's the best when everyone can heal together. The relationship's so much stronger through it afterwards.
It's so interesting how we as parents are learning, even through conversations like this, where we're talking about what therapists do and what the one trusted adult does. And, we talked a lot in our last interview with you 8 months ago about the one trusted adult, which I just love that concept. And I wish, and I think a lot of parents wish that they could be more of that non-judgmental, sounding board for their child. But it's really hard to straddle that line between being a parent and being a friend. Do you think that the parents are ever the one trusted adult?
Yeah, I think they are. I mean, it's probably not all the time, right? It's probably the other friend or someone like that. But it doesn't mean that it can't be there. I just think that it's something that takes time and effort and normalizes that. And I think it's modeling a lot, as being that trusted adult. I think to get there, it's showing your child that you are safe and that they can be honest. And that although it's hard, you're going to deal with it constructively. All of the grad students that we support who work in schools, the hardest part for them is making it clear that they're not the disciplinarian at the school. They're the mental health provider because it's hard to mix those roles. And as a caregiver, as a parent, you don't get to take those hats off. Sometimes you have to, set expectations and follow through. And sometimes you get to, just be unconditionally loving and silly and all those things. But, I think that's sort of the double-edged sword of being a parent.
As a parent of an almost 28-year-old and a 31-year-old, I have just given up on that. Like, I'm just always going to be the mom. I can't help it. I mean, I'm fun and I'm cool, but
Yeah, I don't think it's important to be like the cool parent. As long as they like you, that's good enough.
Yeah, exactly. I found myself texting my 28-year-old just today, some advice on what he should do, and then why do I do this? Moving on. We said in the intro a little bit about this year's legislative session, and I'm wondering specifically, you mentioned some policy that is really favorable towards our youth, but what specifically? I know there were some, there's the good, the bad, and the ugly of some of the bills. Can you talk to anything that we really should know about for our children, our youth?
Yeah, I would really encourage everyone, all the listeners, to really focus on bills and any legislation that is really targeting character development and social emotional learning and those kind of skills. Because like we talked about before, those are very important, especially in conjunction with some of the existing policy. And so, use your voice, talk to your legislators, but also talk to your school communities and really talk about why this is important. And we saw that firsthand during this legislative session. There was a couple bills that were presented, and they were largely workshopped and really changed in many ways and not really moved forward. And so I think that really speaks to where our population here in Utah feels broadly about making sure our kids are empowered and can really do well with whatever comes their way. So I would really encourage people to keep that on the radar. I imagine we'll see more policy in the future. And then of course, just other policy around youth health. There's always legislation coming out, and I think it's everything from funding potentially being cut to other issues around access. So just keep your eyes on that and make sure you can advocate because I think that your all's voice is probably the most powerful, especially when it comes to our legislators.
Sure. Well, I know you work with Live Like Sam, and they provide a lot of great programming all around the area. I know that they're doing some SEL, social emotional learning initiatives, and I can't imagine why, but apparently this is controversial for some people. Could you share a little bit about what the controversy is and what the heart of social emotional learning is?
Yeah, I think that when we hear about the worries around social emotional learning, it comes from a place of really not truly understanding what the content is and what it's not. And I think that when social emotional learning was first really becoming more prominent within our communities, I think that it was really being kind of meshed within lots of prevention strategies and really trying to be as accessible as possible to really all students. And I think that, at least in my experience, that initial pushback really has subsided, and people really understand more about what social emotional learning is. And really, it's about teaching relationship skills, whether it be friends or potentially down the road, partners, but also being able to teach critical thinking and problem-solving skills, empathy and care for yourself and but also for others and your community. And so there's these really, at least my read of the literature is that these are foundational things that we can find not only in schools but in communities, religious organizations. These are the foundational building blocks that we have to be kind to the people that are in our spaces and importantly being kind to ourselves. And I don't think that's talked about enough. And I think we see too many youth who forget to show themselves love and to care for themselves at the expense of trying to please other people. So, I think if we're trying to get upstream and do preventive work, social emotional skill development, social emotional learning, that's the crux of it really for all of us. And it's going to benefit longer, in the long run with employment, with retention in jobs, all of those pieces.
Yeah, sure, that makes sense. We know we've watched a lot of great things happening with Live Like Sam, and you've worked with them for a few years. What have you seen in the arc of your involvement with them and your general work with youth that gives you real hope? We call this the resilient youth segment because we don't believe that youth are hell in a handbasket. We believe in their future. So what, give us some good news.
Yeah, well, Live Like Sam's programs are really, capitalizing on those things I mentioned before, really empowering youth, but really in different spaces. I mean, they have programs where one of them is called Sages and Seekers, and so they're people across the lifespan who are coming together and having shared experiences in the real world, doing things in nature, which is amazing. And I think that's just one program, but having something that resonates within the community and Live Like Sam does because it's community born and spread. And what I think's been really great in the time that I've been involved is just seeing how much it's grown and the expanse being the Wasatch County, but also across the state. I mean, people are getting word of what's going on, and I think everyone's really looking for that local option to really bring people together.
Erin, I wanted to get into cyberbullying because we talked about it a lot last time, and I have a feeling that in 8 months, again, maybe the new needle has moved. And I'd love to someday where we say, "Oh, remember that thing called social media way back when? Oh, isn't that great? We don't have that anymore." But it's very much a part of young people's lives and a lot of adults as well. What are the new things happening to, make ourselves resilient against cyberbullying?
I think I've seen a lot of really great community education. I went to a screening of a movie called Screenagers, and it was like the elementary edition of that, and the local Salt Lake County community organization put that on. But it was really nice because I could bring my kids to it, and they talked about, the issues of being on screens and the issues of social media and those parts that are just existent in everyone's lives. And so that was really exciting because I could not only have conversations with my own kids, but I could see all the other parents and caregivers having conversations with their kids. So I think it's about normalizing this, that like, hey, social media exists and it can hurt you, just like we would with fire or anything else. And like, there's parameters, there's safeguards, there's things that we can do to keep our kids safe, but we have to do that from the second they get the tablet in their hand. It's too late if we're thinking about, safeguards and stuff after the fact.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you look pretty young, so I'm assuming that your kids are quite young. But, at what age do we start talking to them about social media? Is it that sort of thing, like it's never too early?
I mean, I think that there's, obviously like a point, like if they're not on social media, if they don't know about it, I don't know if we necessarily need to say, hey, there's this whole world that's out there, get ready. But when they start asking you questions like, oh, hey, like what's this thing I saw, or my friend has this thing, that's probably a good time to start talking about it. For us, I have an 8 and 11-year-old, and once they got their smartwatches, it really was great for us because we could kind of, be in touch with them, but then they wanted to connect with their friends. And so that's when we had to start having the conversation around 7, 8, saying, hey, you're not going to get a smart device that has those apps until earliest 16. And if it's up to me, I would go until you're like 24. So your brain's developing, but somewhere in between there. And I think something that's really helpful that the listeners can do is kind of come together with your kids' social group and have a similar expectation of being on or off social media, just so that there's not this like nagging peer pressure from, any one source, which is hard, but I think that we've seen success when everyone says, nope, no one's getting the apps until they're 16.
Yeah, it kind of helps to have almost a parent consortium where you all work together on the plan so that one kid doesn't have it and bug all the rest of the kids to have it. Because it really helps that our son is in 7th grade and he and most of his friends are all on their parents' account. So they might have a tablet, but everything that he does goes through mine. And there is, as much as it can be a little bit of a pain sometimes, there is a huge comfort in being able to filter that information and just to kind of, if there is a little, something goes a little awry, you can see what's happening and see how they handle it and, what they're able to do. Well, this has been a great discussion. We're talking with Erin Fisher, who works with not only Live Like Sam, but the Huntsman Mental Health. Is it the Huntsman Mental Health Center?
It's the Huntsman Mental Health Institute at the
Yes.
University of Utah.
Wonderful. And we appreciate all you do, keeping an eye on and helping develop great things and great resilience for our youth. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much. It was great to spend some time with you all again today.